that are sentences. Think about something like, not true, period. I think many people would want to call that a sentence. As I've been talking about, we tend to think about sentences in writing. It's much clearer because you say, well, it ends with a period. In speech, how do we know where a sentence ends? Intonation is one clue that often there'll be a downturn at the end of a sentence, as I did there, at the end of a sentence. But could you know whether that downturn was a period or was that downturn a semicolon? Does it matter? And when you look at real speech in real time spoken by real speakers, what you see is that we often don't speak in full sentences, and we often have long run-ons where it's hard to tell exactly where this sentence is ending. There are lots of ands and buts and the like when we speak. We need to accept that sentences are written products. It's not that they don't have counterparts in the spoken, because we clearly do speak in clauses, and we often have breaks in between clauses that seem like sentence breaks. But the period is a written imposition onto grammar that separates out sentences. This highlights the difference between speech and writing, which will be a theme throughout the course. Often we're asked to follow conventions in written language that put written language at odds with the way we speak. This isn't a bad thing necessarily, but it is a thing worth noting. For example, one study in the Longman grammar shows that in speech, we contract do plus not almost 100% of the time. In other words, when we speak, we say don't. And when we have something like will plus not, we say won't, can plus not can't, about 95% of the time. Many of us, however, have been told that in formal writing, we shouldn't contract, except maybe for emphasis. I grew up with that prescription, and I still tend to follow it in formal writing. But the convention is changing as contractions sneak their way into more formal prose. Maybe you're not a fan of contractions in published prose. And if you're feeling concerned about it, maybe Brian Garner can help in terms of how he writes about contractions in his usage guide. He counters the concern that contractions can make writing seem too breezy. And he argues that with contractions, we can gain, and to quote him, relaxed sincerity. And this is an important thing to think about. It's one of the things that more spoken features like contractions can do when we write. It's again a reason not to adhere too strictly to just one rule, but to think about exactly what we're trying to achieve in our writing. At the same time, Garner warns us, and it's a warning worth heeding, to not contract recklessly and to avoid contractions in solemn contexts because they wouldn't be appropriate. What's clear here is that these are rhetorical choices. These are about what we're trying to achieve as writers in terms of tone, in terms of formality. I find this a more interesting way to look at a usage rule, such as the one about contractions, than thinking about it in terms of whether we should or shouldn't use contractions in some more absolute way, as if there was something inherently wrong with contractions. All this background on lexical categories, phrases, and clauses sets us up to dive into the details of these grammatical building blocks. And as we do, we'll be able to address some important usage questions. Here's one I got the other day over email. The question was, what is the plural of emoji? Those are those little images we can use, like the eggplant or the smiley face that we can use when we're texting. This person who emailed me said, is it emoji or emojis? And how would we decide? To answer that, on we go to the next lecture to talk about nouns and all their quirky plurals, among other usage issues.
Lecture 5. Fewer octopuses or less octopi?
As I mentioned in the first lecture, my mother cared a lot about language, and she took a largely prescriptive approach with her children's language education. As a result, I have been aware of the less-fewer distinction that usage issue since I was a kid, because my mother would regularly point out grocery store signs that said 10 items or less and remind me that to be grammatically correct, the sign should say 10 items or fewer. Why should the sign say 10 items or fewer? This comes down to a distinction between countable and uncountable nouns. Because items can be counted, the idea is that that should take fewer. It seems straightforward, but you may not be surprised to hear that it's not. Both because many speakers and writers don't observe the distinction between less and fewer, and because sometimes it sounds wrong to do what we're told is technically right. This is one of the several usage issues, this less-fewer distinction, that exists around nouns, and we're going to cover these in this lecture. Here's the outline for this lecture. We're going to start by talking about countability with nouns, which will address the less-fewer distinction. Then we'll talk about irregular plurals. Octopus, emoji, how do those words make plural? And then finally, we'll deal with collective nouns, like jury. Is that one body in the singular or 12 people in the plural? And while we're talking about words like jury, we'll deal with some other agreement issues, such as, is it there are a few reasons, or can you ever say there's a few reasons? To start, let's return to the less-fewer distinction and the idea of countability. Countability is exactly what it sounds like. It's about whether we can count the noun or not, or count the thing the noun refers to. A prototypical countable noun would be pencil. You can clearly count pencils, a pencil, three pencils. A prototypical uncountable noun would be water. You can't count water, you just have water. But there are ways in English to count uncountable nouns, and we do it with measure words. For example, we can count drops of water, cups of water, buckets of water. These measure words can refer to a part of the whole of the uncountable noun, such as a grain of sand, or a container, such as a bottle of beer, or a quantity, such as a stack of hay. With many uncountable nouns, we can also make them countable creatively with a shift in meaning. For example, if you take beer, which is generally uncountable, but you use beer to refer to a bottle of beer, it suddenly becomes countable, as in, we had two beers. You could do the same thing with love. Love in general is uncountable, but let's imagine that you've had two loves in your life. Suddenly it is countable. You can do that with a lot of uncountable nouns, but perhaps the word everlasting cannot be made countable. Unless, of course, you're referring to the flower, in which case you can count them. But let's accept the general distinction between countable and uncountable nouns. Once you have that, you have the rule about less and fewer. Now, fewer, which we're supposed to use with countable nouns, tends to mind its own business in actual usage. It is the word less that is used with both countable and uncountable nouns. Now, there are expressions where less is used with countable nouns that are unremarkable, such as 500 words or less, or less than 2 weeks. But then there are the expressions that many people find more jarring. For example, an advertisement that says it kills 90% or you have 90% less germs. Or there was another ad that advertised a drink as having 50% less calories. For some people, that is like nails on a chalkboard. Now, this use of less with countable nouns is not as new as you may think it is. In fact, it's not new at all. Less has been doing this, has been modifying countable nouns, since Old English. The fact that we may think it is new is something that's known as the recency illusion. I briefly mentioned this earlier in the course as well. It refers to the idea, and this was coined by Arnold Zwicky at Stanford, a linguist at Stanford in 2005, to refer to this idea that when we notice something for the first time, something that's happening in the language, we can often assume that it is new or recent, which is why we noticed it. And then when we look into it, often it's not as new as we think it is. So, where does this rule about less and fewer come from? It actually seems to have started as a personal preference. A personal preference that was written down in 1770 by Robert Baker in his book, Reflections on the English Language. And I want to quote for you what he writes, because the wording is really important here. So here's Baker. This word less is most commonly used in speaking of a number, where I should think fewer would do better. No fewer than 100 appears to me not only more elegant than no less than 100, but more strictly proper. In other words, we hear him expressing a preference of what he thinks would be more elegant or what sounds better to him. But by the time we get to Strunk's Elements of Style, which he published as a single-authored book first in 1918, it has become a rule. This is no longer about a personal preference. In Elements of Style, under less, it says, should not be misused for fewer. And it goes on to say, less is for quantity, fewer is for number. This is no longer about preference. This is about right and wrong. But it's not that clear-cut in usage. As the American Heritage Dictionary recognizes, if you look at what feels idiomatic in American English and other varieties as well, you see less used with things that we can count. For example, we like less with measures of time, even though things like days are countable. For example, less than 3 days. We also like less with measures of amount, even when those are countable, like dollars. We will often say less than $200. We also like less with measures of distance, even though measures like miles are countable. We'll say less than 100 miles. In addition, the phrase more or less appears with count nouns all the time that will say 100 cans more or less. Finally, there's the expression one less thing to worry about. Now, things are countable, but most of us would not say one fewer thing to worry about. Brian Garner, in his Dictionary of American Usage, the second edition, which was published in 2003, explains that less tends to go with a singular noun. In other words, when thing is singular, one thing, we'll say one less thing. Garner's discussion of less and fewer is interesting because he blames supermarkets for fewer sad fate. That is, that fewer is on the decline. And Garner certainly doesn't seem happy about it. I think you know that whenever someone uses the word hegemony to refer to a word, that word is in trouble. Here's what Garner writes. The linguistic hegemony by which less has encroached on fewer's territory is probably now irreversible. What has clinched this development is something as mundane as the express checkout lines in supermarkets. They're typically bedecked with signs cautioning 15 items or less. These signs are all but ubiquitous in the United States. But the occasional more literate supermarket owner uses a different sign, 15 or fewer items. Now, I think one could easily argue that 15 items or less is very idiomatic. And I am not prepared to condemn it as illiterate compared with the more literate 15 or fewer items. I'd rather go with a distinction between colloquial or idiomatic for 15 items or less and more formal for 15 items or fewer. So what are we to do as writers? Go with what sounds right? I would say with measures, with time, and with distance, yes, go with what sounds right. But with other constructions, such as those germs or the calories, I would say proceed with caution. When the usage panel was surveyed on this in 2006, only 28% of the panel accepted the sentence, "The region needs more jobs, not less jobs." Now, that may feel pretty idiomatic to you, it does to me, but in writing, to use less that way may be a flag. It's not that it's ambiguous if you use less where some people would like you to use fewer, or in any way confusing. but there is still some gatekeeping with this construction. As a side note here, perhaps this discussion has you thinking about amount versus number. The difference between amount and number is also about uncountable versus countable. And here too, we see amount, which is for uncountable nouns, much like less, encroaching on the territory of number. So you will find, including in published writing, expressions like the amount of people. People is plural and countable, but you'll get the amount of people. That said, I would say be careful here. This use of amount is very colloquial and could get you judged in any kind of formal writing, probably even more than mixing up less and fewer. The rest of this lecture is going to be about singular-plural issues also, but from a couple of different angles. Countable nouns with irregular plurals, and collective nouns like jury, in terms of how to handle agreement, as well as a few other agreement issues, including there is versus there are with plural nouns. Let's start with irregular plurals. The irregular plurals are a mixture of native English irregular plurals and borrowed ones, which come in and make the language irregular. It can seem like a chaotic mess when you get into these irregular plurals, but there are actually patterns that are worth sorting out. Let's start with the set of irregular plurals that are native forms, because these irregular forms tell us something about the history of the language. There are three main categories of irregular plurals that go back to earlier stages in English. The en plurals, such as oxen, zero plurals, such as sheep, and words that take a vowel change, as in man, men. English used to have a few regular ways of making plurals. Nouns were in different categories, and each category had a different way of making plurals. One of those categories had a final S. That's become the regular way of making plurals. But we have remnants of some of the other categories. One of those, you created the plural by adding an at the end, and that has now become en. We used to have many more of these nouns that ended with vowel plus n, but over time, they have become regular. For example, shoein becomes shoes. Eyen becomes eyes. All we have left in this category are children, which is healthy, oxen, and I'm not so sure about that. I think that that may get replaced by oxes because we just don't encounter, many of us don't encounter oxen that much anymore. And finally, brethren. And brethren has already specialized so that brothers are one thing and brethren are something else. Another regular way of making plurals in Old English was with a zero ending. And we still see that with sheep and with deer. Interestingly, this class has expanded over time, as opposed to the nouns that take plural with en, which has shrunk over time. That category has expanded to encompass, for example, fish. Fish actually used to make the plural with s, so you had fishes. And it is still fishes if you're referring to multiple species, or if you're in the Godfather movie and have the unfortunate fate of sleeping with the fishes. Occasionally, and this is fascinating to me, a borrowed word will come into the language and take a zero plural. The word moose was borrowed into English from Algonquin, and it became a zero plural in English. This raises the question for us of what should be the plural of emoji. This word is borrowed in from Japanese. It refers to those pictorial characters we can use when we text, and there has been some discussion about what the plural is. There are two possibilities, emoji, zero plural, or emojis with the regular S. Right now, you can find both in published writing. I think the trend is going toward emojis to just make this a regular plural in English. The vowel change plurals reflect a very old stage of Germanic. This goes back even before Old English, where there was a plural ending, and that plural ending caused a vowel change earlier in the word. That ending has long since fallen off. It was gone by Old English. But its effects on the stem are still there. And we can see it in goose, geese, man, men, mouse, mice. But mouse, mice, we now have a new meaning of mouse for those of us, all of us, using computers. You have the computer mouse. What is the plural of a computer mouse? Is it computer mouses or computer mice? Many dictionaries list both as standard. Usage seems to be now favoring computer mice. And I have to say somehow that one just cracks me up. Somehow the mice are scurrying as opposed to I've gotten used to just a computer mouse. So those are some irregular plurals that have come down from earlier stages in English. Now let's look at irregular plurals that have happened through borrowing. And this happens because English is an omnivorous language. We have borrowed words from so many languages, and those languages, of course, make plurals in ways that are different from English, and sometimes those different plurals come into English. One very common set of irregular plurals stems from Latin borrowings that end in us, such as syllabus, focus, status. Now here's the kicker with these words, that not all of these Latin words that end in us come from the same declension in Latin. So they have different plural formations in Latin, which further confuses the issue in English. And then there are a few words that end in us, like hippopotamus, which aren't from Latin at all. Let's look at the effect of all of this on English. And again, we're sorting out what otherwise can look a bit chaotic. Most borrowings from Latin that end in us take a plural with the final I. So this would be focus, foci, stimulus, stimuli, alumnus, alumni. That's what happens in Latin. It's what happens in English. For all of those words I just listed, the I plural is still the most common in English. But some of them, and I think particularly focus, are starting to get Englishified. I think that at this point, foci as the plural may sound too formal or potentially even a little bit forced, even when you're writing formally. One set of these US words that end in I have already become Englishified. For example, with a crocus, we talk about crocuses, not croquis. With the word alumnus, there's some confusion. And I think the confusion stems from the fact that there is a feminine form. You have alumnus, which is masculine, and alumna, which is feminine. And the plural of alumnus is alumni. The plural of alumna is alumnae. That's why people are confused. If you want to get out of that, just shorten it to alum, and then the plural is alums. Now, I will be honest with you that I had long put syllabus in this category of Latin borrowings that take a final I to become plural. But it turns out that the history of syllabus is more complicated. It's borrowed from modern Latin, and it seems to stem from a scribal error that misread the Greek. It was actually a different word. So the Latinate plural syllabi is not etymologically founded, but it has taken hold. The Oxford English Dictionary has both syllabuses and syllabi as the plural of the word. In British English, you'll tend to hear syllabuses. In American English, syllabi. Brian Garner thinks we are perhaps overfond of syllabi in the US. Right now, I think you can safely use either. Then there are U.S. borrowings from Latin that keep the U.S. in Latin. There would have been a vowel change in Latin, but that gets lost. So the plural of apparatus is apparatus, and of status is status, if we stay true to the Latin, which we have not done. And for most speakers, these now have become regular English plurals, apparatuses and statuses. And if you put that into Microsoft Word, the spell checker doesn't flag them. There's a third pretty small set of words that end in US that take what looks to us like an irregular plural. This would be a word like corpus, which becomes corpora, or genus, which becomes genera. That's a pretty highly academic plural. The OED already includes genuses as the plural of genus, but it doesn't yet include corpuses. But I think if you wait, corpuses will come into. So those are all Latin borrowings ending in US. Then there are two common words people often mistake for Latin borrowings. The first is hippopotamus. Hippopotamus is Greek, not Latin. It refers to a river horse. Many dictionaries recommend a regular ES ending to create hippopotamuses, but they also recognize that many folks use the I, hippopotami. Again, if you're looking for a way out, shorten it to hippo and make it totally regular with hippos. Now, what about octopus? Octopus is also Greek, and it goes back to octa, eight, plus pous, for foot. The stem is octopod, which means that the plural would technically be octopodes. Octopus shows up in English in the mid-18th century. Before that, we referred to this creature as a polypus. I mean, who knew how many feet it had? In the late 19th century, the plural was usually octopi, but by around the 1930s and 40s, octopuses became the major form. Now it's more than twice as common to say octopuses than octopi, and that is common in general works as well as biological journals. Now, if we were going to be technically correct, the plural would be octopodes. But that has never gained much momentum, and I have to say that if you were to use octopodes, you might be out there on your own. The takeaway here about irregular plurals is that they are idiosyncratic, and some of them are moving toward regular English plurals, and some are not. I'm afraid that there is not better advice than to look in standard dictionaries and usage guides when you're in doubt, and realize that there will be some differences of opinion here. Also, remember that Latin plurals may sometimes be read as the most correct form, and sometimes as a slightly pretentious form. Before leaving borrowed words, let's address one big usage issue, and that is with data. Technically, data is plural, as it is plural in Latin. The singular is datum. But in English, this word, data, has been reinterpreted as a singular mass noun. As a result, you will find the data shows, as opposed to the data show. You will get this data, singular, as well as, or instead of, those data. Both the singular and the plural for data are now in common usage, with a preference for the plural in academic writing and a preference for the singular in the spoken. So given that singular data is more common in the spoken, I can tell you where I would put my money. I always put my money on the spoken. I would guess that singular data in the end will probably win. At this point, only 34% of the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel still rejects data as a singular, which is interesting. You can see how the gatekeeping is changing here. The sentence the panel was given was, "Once the data is in, we can begin to analyze it." And 92% of the panel accept the expression "very little data," as opposed to "very few data." American Heritage Dictionary, as a result, calls singular data standard. As a writer and editor myself, I simply try to be consistent. If you're going to use data as singular, do that all the time. If it's plural, do that all the time. Data, the word, has raised one agreement issue, data is versus data are. So let's run with this question of agreement. First, let's talk about collective nouns. Jury, group, family, couple. There are two ways to think about this, meaning and geography. Let's start with meaning. Are you thinking about this group as a unit or as separate individuals? It matters in terms of agreement. If you're thinking about them as a group, let's take the noun family. You could say something like, "Her family is highly educated." You're thinking about the family as a collective. But now let's imagine you're thinking about the family as several individuals. In that case, you could say, "His family are all doctors." Now let's talk about this in terms of geography. If you're from the US, you likely use the singular and say, "The jury is." If you're from the UK, you likely use plural agreement and say, "The jury are." Now, some familiar collectives are singular no matter where you are in relation to the pond. One of those would be the United States, which tends always to be singular. Now, things can get muddy when that collective noun is followed by a prepositional phrase, such as a jury of my peers. Is it a jury of my peers is or a jury of my peers are? A group of my friends are going, a group of my friends is going. American grammar guides often allow some variation here, again based on meaning, depending on whether something like a group refers to the individuals in the group or to the unit. So let's imagine I'm talking about my group of friends and I'm talking about them as individuals. I could say, my group of friends are going different ways after college because each one is going a different way. In all of these examples about agreement that I've just given you, the noun comes before the verb, the jury is versus the jury are. Now, what if the noun comes after the verb? This is where things can get even trickier. This is the last tricky agreement issue we'll talk about in this lecture. And it happens with constructions that involve existential there, as in there is versus there are. Now, let's imagine this sentence. There is a spider on your head. The grammatical subject there is there. It's what we call existential there. The notional subject actually comes after the verb. The notional subject is a spider. The prescriptive rule on this is that the notional subject, which is coming after the verb, governs agreement. So there's no problem in a sentence like, there is a spider on your head, because the notional subject is singular. But let's imagine that there are actually three spiders on your head. I could say, there are three spiders on your head. But could I also say, there's three spiders on your head? You'll notice that there I've got the singular is with the three spiders. What's happening here is that we often contract the existential there with is to create theirs. And this has become formulaic enough that it sometimes doesn't matter what the number of the noun following it is. So whether the notional subject is singular or plural, theirs has already contracted and is functioning as the focuser in the sentence. So we can say there's a reason for that, or often, then sometimes we'll say, or often we'll say, there's three reasons for that. When you think about the job of theirs, really what it's doing is introducing what we'd call a semantically heavy bit of information. It's putting that in the second half of the sentence where speakers expect sort of something that's semantically heavy, something that's important, and we say, there's three spiders on your head. There's three reasons. In an interesting study by Bill Crawford, who's a linguist at Northern Arizona University, he found that with existential there constructions and plural nouns, we tend to use theirs 50% of the time in speech. In other words, when we're speaking, we would say, there's three spiders on your head half the time. And he looked at academic lectures and discovered in academic lectures, we do it 45% of the time. We'd say things like, there's three reasons. The Longman grammar notes that there are some analogous constructions where you get a singular and get a notional subject that's plural. For example, here's your shoes, or how's things? Now, obviously, those expressions are more colloquial. In formal writing, we're much less likely to contract the there and the verb, much more likely to keep it there is and there are, and more likely to let the following noun govern the agreement. My recommendation here would be to be careful and to let the notional subject govern in formal writing. But I do want to note that it is quite idiomatic to use theirs with plural nouns in speech and in informal writing. For better or worse, we are far from finished with tricky agreement issues, and we're going to cover two more in the next lecture. Here's one of them. Is it none of the books is or none of the books are? The pronoun none is technically singular, but the noun books is clearly plural. With that lead-in, let's turn to pronouns.
Lecture 6, Between You and Your Pronouns.
One of my favorite Calvin and Hobbes cartoons involves pronouns. Calvin is sitting at a desk doing homework, and he says to Hobbes, "I need help on my homework. What's a pronoun?" Hobbes replies, "A noun that has lost its amateur status." There's a pause in the cartoon, and then Calvin says, "Maybe I can get a point for originality." I love that definition. It's not going to get you very far in a grammar review, but it's wonderfully clever. Let's, however, try to do a little bit better, probably not in cleverness, but at least in accuracy. So before we address several prominent usage issues related to pronouns, let's define our terms. If we take the word pronoun, we can see that it's created from pro plus noun, which suggests that a pronoun is a word that's standing in for a noun. That's kind of accurate, but not entirely accurate, because in fact, what a pronoun does is it stands in for a noun phrase. Sometimes that will be just a noun. For example, spinach is good for you. We could then substitute in it for spinach. It's just a noun. It is good for you. But pronouns often are substituting in for a longer noun phrase. For example, the book that I just finished is great. And then we could substitute in it for the book that I just finished. It is great. Now, pronouns are some of the most common words in the language, along with articles and prepositions. One study of the most common words in spoken British English found the and at the top of the list. The pronoun I was in third, then you at sixth, that at seventh. And that, I have to say, is a little complicated because it's both a determiner and a pronoun. It came in at ninth, this at 13th, and he at 17th. In the corpus of contemporary American English, the most common words once again put the, be, and at the top of the list. It comes in at 10th, I is in 11th, that at 12th, you at 14th, he at 15th, this at 20th, and they at 21st. You can see how important function words are to the language and how often we use them. Pronouns are central to the function words. Now, there are several categories of pronouns, and we're going to start with the personal pronouns, several of which figured in these lists of the most common words, pronouns such as I, you, it, he, and they. And I can't give you a particularly good explanation of why we talk about he more than she other than a cultural one. I will leave it to you to make your own decisions about what's happening there. With the personal pronouns, we often hear reference to first person, second person, and third person. And I thought I'd quickly review those. Those terms are about where people are with respect to the discourse or the text. Let me explain. The pronouns can stand in for the person who is doing the talking. That would be the first person, I or we. They can also be for the other person in the discourse, the person that the speaker is talking to. That would be the second person, which would be you. Then you have the third person, which is the people or things that we are talking about that are being discussed. That would be he, she, it, and they. Because personal pronouns are so common in the language, they tend to be quite stable over time. But English has a couple of notable exceptions. The first of these exceptions is the pronouns they, them, and their. These pronouns are borrowed into Old English from Old Norse in the Old English period. It speaks to the intense language contact that was happening between Old Norse speakers and Old English speakers after the Viking invasions in the 8th and 9th centuries. It is highly unusual to borrow pronouns this way, but English did. And there's some chance that those TH forms, they, them, and their, we're providing a useful distinction in the language. It's not that Old English didn't have pronouns for the third person plural. It did, but they started with H, as does the third person singular, he. So the TH pronouns introduced a useful distinction. Let me now turn to the second exception of a pronoun that suddenly appears in English, and that would be the pronoun she. The origins of she are, in fact, unclear. Old English did have a word for she. It was heo, spelled H-E-O. She first appears in 1154 in the north of England. Again, it may have been that she provided a useful distinction. It was more different from he. Now, the first usage issue with personal pronouns that we need to discuss is between you and I. And I say need to discuss because this is a pet peeve for many people. And since we're already talking about Old English, let's talk about the case system, because we need this background to understand what's happening with between you and I. After we talk about between you and I, we'll talk about the singular generic pronoun question. Then we'll talk about who and whom. Then indefinite pronouns like none. And finally, the question of how we use the pronoun this in academic writing. I know that's a lot, but there are a lot of usage issues around pronouns. Okay, so back to case. Case is a grammatical system that distinguishes the function of a noun or a pronoun based on its function in a clause or in a sentence. If we look at the personal pronouns, we can see that most of them distinguish three cases: subject, object, be that direct or indirect or the object of a preposition, and possessive. For example, in the first person, singular, we have subject I, object me, possessive mine. In the plural, we, us, ours. If we do the third person, we see very similar distinctions. For example, in the masculine, subject he, object him, possessive his. In the feminine, subject she, object her, possessive hers. Let's now do third person plural. They, them, theirs. If we do the neuter in the singular with it, we see we only have two distinctions instead of three. We have subject it, object it, possessive it. Finally, let's look at the second person. We have subject you, object you, possessive yours. Again, you'll notice that there's no distinction between the subject and object. This has collapsed over time. There used to be a distinction in English. It was subject ye and object you. In older forms of English, you would get something like ye are fantastical versus I beseech you. But even by the time of Shakespeare, you see Shakespeare mixing up his yees and yous, and now we have you for subject and you for object. Now, in Old English, all nouns made these kinds of distinctions between subject, object, and possessive. And within the object category, there were also distinctions between direct objects and indirect objects, and sometimes objects of prepositions. Now, all we have left with nouns is the possessive S. And the pronouns are the ones that still prop up the historical case system. But here's the thing. Given that we don't have to make this distinction between subject and object anywhere else in the grammar, we can sometimes get a little mixed up with our pronouns, and we can interchange subject and object pronouns when the syntax gets complicated. And it gets complicated in conjoined constructions such as X and Y. Think between you and I. Now, in most varieties of English around the world, and that includes American and British English, but it's not true of all varieties, if the personal pronoun occurs by itself, you tend to consistently get I in subject position and me in object position. In other words, you'll get things like, I went to the store, my mother called me. But if you create an X and Y situation with I and me, you will hear some variations. You'll hear things like, me and my mom went to the store, and my mother called my sister and I. This would be as opposed to the standard construction, my mom and I went to the store, or my mother called my sister and me. What's happening here? The first thing that I want to say is that this is not new. Here is an example from Shakespeare's Othello. Yes, you have seen Cassio and she together. And here's another example from The Merchant of Venice. All debts are cleared between you and I. These may sound strikingly modern to you if you think that between you and I is just a modern thing. Patricia O'Connor, who wrote the entertaining grammar, Woe is I, has examples of constructions like between you and I back into the Middle English period, and she's found criticism of the construction back to the 18th century. So it's not new, even though many people think it is, but that doesn't answer the question about what is happening here. I'm going to focus particularly on the construction between you and I. It is possible that conjoined constructions of the X and Y variety may not follow the same rules as single pronouns. So while you would get an accusative me alone, the conjoined my sister and I may not have to take the object case after, say, a preposition. So you would say for me, but perhaps it's possible to just say for my sister and I. In other words, that the phrase X and I could become a routinized expression. It becomes fixed. And that way it doesn't matter if it's the subject or the object. My sister and I went for my sister and I. I think that we want that preposition in for my sister and me or my sister and I to function distributively. It's like math, where it would distribute to both the X and the Y. So you would get for me, for my sister, so for my sister and me. But it looks like maybe it doesn't. For lots of speakers, it is for my sister and I. Now, to say that these expressions, these conjoined expressions, are routinized and to explain how they might happen is not the same as saying that they are standard. We still would need to say that standard usage is between you and me. But interestingly, at this point, I think we may need to say that polite usage, or perhaps hyper-polite usage for many speakers, including highly educated ones, is between you and I. I tend to go with the standard form, between you and me, as opposed to the hyper-polite, or some might call it hyper-correct form. And it is always safe to go with between you and me, especially in edited prose. In the long run, I'm not sure what will happen here. There is some chance, if we think in the way distant future, that the distinction between subject and object pronouns might collapse all the way through the system. If you think that sounds like a terrible fate, just remember that the distinction between subject and object has already collapsed for the pronoun you, and we all survived. While we're on personal pronouns and collapsing distinctions, let's talk about another collapse in the second person pronouns that we have managed to survive. This is the collapse of the distinction between the singular and the plural in the second person. We used to make a distinction here. We had singular, thou and thee, and plural, ye and you. Thou became the familiar form, and now it's mostly dead, other than for Quakers and some old plays and novels. Now, it is true that we have created some new plural second person pronouns to recreate this distinction, although in standard varieties, you can function both as a singular and a plural. But new plural forms include things like y'all, you guys, yous, yous guys, yins, if you live in Pittsburgh. And there are reports that in some parts of Texas, y'all has become singular and the new plural is all y'all. In standard English, though, you can function as both a singular and a plural, and it's worth noting that we continue to use the verb are both when it's singular and plural. This fact about you is relevant to what is known as the generic pronoun problem. This problem arises when we need to refer back to a noun phrase, what's called the antecedent. A noun phrase that refers to a person whose gender is unspecified, unknown, or irrelevant. Let me give you an example to show you what I'm talking about. Here's a sentence. A person at that level should not have to keep track of the hours put in. Should not have to keep track of the hours he puts in, she puts in, he or she puts in, they put in. This sentence was a sentence on the American Heritage Dictionary usage ballot when they were asking us what pronoun we thought was acceptable for a generic person, a person of unspecified gender. Now, there's also the situation where we don't know the person's gender. This would be something like, we would like to thank the anonymous reviewer for comments. His comments, her comments, their comments, his or her comments. So we have these situations where we have someone who is a person who's truly unspecified gender, or we just don't know the gender, or perhaps we just don't want to tell you. Now, there's an idea out there that we don't have a singular generic pronoun for these situations. And since the 19th century, people have been coming up with some artificial ones to solve the problem. They've come up with pronouns such as he, she, spelled as one word, thon, e, just lowercase e, hiser, and z. Now, none of these have caught on. It's very hard to introduce an artificial pronoun into the language. But here's what I would say about this. We do have a singular generic pronoun, and that pronoun is they. We've been using they as a singular in these situations where we have a person of unspecified gender, unknown gender, irrelevant gender, for several hundred years. If you search the internet for Jane Austen and singular they, you can find a website with all the examples where she used singular they in her writing. You can find examples back into Middle English. Shakespeare does it. And we all, almost all of us, use singular they today, at least in speech. Now, one of the arguments I'll hear is that they cannot be singular. And what I'm going to say is that's actually not an interesting argument to have. They is singular. If you look at usage, they is singular. I can say to you something like, I was talking to a friend of mine, and they said that it's a terrible movie. I was talking to a friend, and they said. They is clearly singular. If you're perhaps thinking, but a pronoun can't be singular and plural at the same time, please remember what we just talked about with the pronoun you, where it is singular and plural at the same time and continues to use plural agreement with the verb, for example, are. So the real question is whether we're going to allow writers to use singular generic they in formal writing. Many of us already use it in informal, less monitored writing, and almost all of us, studies show, use it in speech. So why wouldn't we allow it? The rule that tells us that we should not use singular they in writing, but that instead we should use singular generic he, originates in the 18th century. It was first recorded in Anne Fisher's grammar, and then it was picked up in Lindley Murray's wildly popular grammar at the end of the 18th century. So for about 200 years, we lived with the rule that we should use generic he, as in a person at that level should not have to record his time. In the 1970s, with second wave feminism, we started to get some pushback against generic he. And over time, it was successfully replaced with four different options for what we could do in this situation where we need a generic singular pronoun. The first option was use he or she. And that's fine, although it can get a little bulky if you need to use a lot of those if you have a string of them in a row. He or she, his or her, and he or she just gets a little bulky. Another solution is to alternate he or she by sentence or by paragraph. Again, this is okay, but I have to say as a reader, I can find it a little discombobulating if an unknown person's gender appears to be changing before my very eyes. A third option is to make the whole sentence plural, and then you can just use they as a plural pronoun. The fourth option is omit the pronoun entirely. Rewrite the sentence so you don't need a pronoun. These are all perfectly fine solutions, but I'm still left with the question of why not also allow us to use singular they in writing? It works well in the spoken language. It's a proven solution with centuries of usage behind it. It's no more ambiguous than other pronouns. Sure, sometimes in a sentence, a pronoun can be ambiguous, but this is true of he, she, and they. And if you have an ambiguous pronoun, rewrite the sentence. As you can probably tell, I am a big fan of singular they, but I also know my audience, and I know not everyone agrees with me on this. My solution right now is to footnote my first use of singular they, and in the footnote, I explain why I'm using this as a singular generic pronoun. And I'll continue to do this until singular they becomes fully acceptable. And I do think this is happening. Some interesting things have been afoot. In 2015, the Washington Post redid its style guidelines to say that writers could use they as a singular generic, as well as to refer to individuals who identify outside the male-female binary. The American Heritage Dictionary usage panel shows decreasing opposition to singular they. At this point, it's almost a 50-50 split on a sentence like the one about the person at that level. And with an indefinite pronoun, such as, if anyone calls, tell them I can't come to the phone, more than half the panel accepted that sentence. Now, I recognize that it may still strike your eye as wrong in writing to use singular they. But I would guess that even you use singular they in your speech sometimes. And if you are a writer who would like to use singular they in your writing as a generic pronoun, I would say we're entering an era where this is close to becoming standard usage. We're not quite there yet, but we're close. As I mentioned, there have been some artificial pronouns suggested along the way, and Z has now gotten some traction as a transgender pronoun, along with they. It is also sometimes used, both Z and they, for individuals who identify outside the male-female binary. There is a debate going on right now on college campuses about whether, for example, on class enrollment forms, you should allow students to specify their pronoun of choice. What is their preferred pronoun? I've been asked about this recently in terms of what do I think, and I have to say, for me, this comes down to an issue of respect. If people have a pronoun that they prefer and they ask you to use that pronoun, it is a signal of respect to use the pronoun that people prefer. And as a result, we create a more inclusive, respectful space. The collapse of case is relevant to another class of pronouns. This would be the interrogative pronouns. These are the pronouns that create questions. We often see this as a list of five: what, which, who, whom, and whose. But I think you could argue that there are only three pronouns here: what, which, and who then has the additional forms for the object and the possessive, whom and whose. Let's focus on who, whom, because this is the biggest usage issue we have here. Who is the subject form of the pronoun, asking for information about people. Whom is the object form, and it is in the decline. But it's actually been in decline for several hundred years. So one interesting question is, why hasn't it died yet? It is healthiest, whom is healthiest, when it comes after a preposition, things like to whom or by whom. Alone, when it appears in a question, it can look like a subject form because it appears first, and I think that's often why we see who. For example, here's a question where we have the subject form. Who is calling you? Who is the subject? Now let's look at one where whom is the object. Whom are you calling? But that question word, the interrogative pronoun, is still at the beginning of the sentence. If we rearrange it to put whom as object, you can see you have you are calling whom. But the way we make questions, whom bumps up to the front, whom are you calling, and many of us will say, who are you calling? Well, I will adhere to the prescriptive notion of when to use whom in my most formal writing. I find that at this point, whom can sound a little fussy in many contexts. I tend to avoid whom in my emails or text messages, either by reworking the sentence so that I don't need who or whom at all, or just by using who.